squat suits, squat briefs, power socks, bench press shirts, and other such items is designed to help powerlifters lift more weight at a meet where such equipment is permitted by the rules. Powerlifting is an extremely technical sport due to the use of this equipment, but it has no place in a program of strength training for athletics and fitness. Remember, lifting more weight is not always the same thing as getting stronger. This should be obvious in light of the principles already discussed regarding squatting and strength. Belts and wraps. Less obvious is the role of belts and knee wraps. A properly designed and adjusted belt is useful as a safety device when you're squatting heavy weights. A belt protects the spine by increasing the amount of pressure that can be applied to it by the muscles that support it. The belt itself reinforces the cylinder of the ab muscles around the spine by providing hoop tension against which to push with your abs. At the same time, the belt acts as a proprioceptive cue for a harder abdominal muscle contraction. You can actually squeeze harder with a belt on than you can without one, just as you can push harder against a loaded barbell than you can against a broomstick. This effect ultimately produces both stronger abs due to the stronger isometric contraction facilitated by the belt and a stronger squat due to the heavier loads made possible by the more stable spine. A squat suit is different in that some of the kinetic energy of the descending bar-loaded eccentric contraction is stored as elastic energy in the suit material and in the compressed skin and muscle under the suit. That energy is then made available to the lifter as he rebounds up, so that the suit is in fact an artificial aid. It has been argued that the belt is too, but a belt does not function across a joint going into a sequence of flexion, stretch reflex, and extension, like a suit does. Spinal support and safety are necessary for our general strength training purposes, while a squat 30% heavier than that which can be done unaided is not. Leave the squat suit for later when you're entered in the meet. A properly designed belt is the same width, usually 4 inches, but probably better 3 inches, all the way around. Many millions of cheap, junky belts have been produced with 2-inch buckles and fronts, and either 4 or 6-inch backs. These belts were designed by someone who did not understand how a belt works. For the belt to function correctly, it must act around the complete circle, and there is no reason for it to be wider in the back than in the front. 4 inches is about the widest belt that most people can get between their ribs and hips. And 3 inches is probably the one that most people need to be using, especially for the deadlift. If it is too wide, and 4 inches may well be too wide for you, the bottom edge will hit the top of the thigh before you get all the way down in the squat. If you're shorter or short-waisted, find a 3-inch belt, and the majority of lifters will find it easier to set the back in the correct start position for a pull from the floor with that narrower belt. Thickness is important in that a very thick, laminated suede belt feels very good under a big load. Such belts are expensive, though, and any good single-ply leather belt with a good buckle will suffice. You may not need a belt at all for the early part of your training career, and if your abs are strong and your back is uninjured, you may prefer to never use one. Very heavy weights have certainly been lifted without one. This is a judgment call, but it is probably prudent to err on the side of safety if there's any question at all about it, or if you have previously injured your back. When a belt is used, it should be used judiciously, possibly restricted to the last warm-up set and the work sets. As a general rule, do not introduce a new variable into the work set. If you're going to wear a belt in the work set, make sure you use it during your last warm-up so that your movement pattern will not be altered or your attention diverted under the heaviest weights of the day. Using the belt correctly is a matter of practice. It must be worn in the right place at the right tightness to be effective, and if it's wrong, it can actually screw up the lift it's designed to support. Put it on around your natural waist, you know, higher than you wear your pants. At a comfortable tightness, take your squat stance and squat down into the bottom position. If it's not too wide, the belt will adjust to the position it wants to settle into, the place where it functions most effectively, and it will have done so before the weight is a factor. Don't let this position adjustment take place at the bottom of the first rep of the heavy set you need the belt for. Do it in advance. Stand back up, tighten the belt to the point at which it adds a little pressure to the gut. There's a common misconception about the use of the belt. Many people have heard that you push the stomach out against the belt. Doing this, however, will result in spinal flexion, the very thing we wear the belt to prevent from happening under a load. Just put the belt on tight, forget it's there, and use your abs the way you would without it. The belt functions without your having to actually use it because the tightness it provides against the abs causes them to work harder without your micromanagement of the situation. The right amount of tightness is a matter of individual preference, but as a general rule, more experienced lifters can wear a tighter belt than novices can. It is also quite possible to have a belt on too tight. If you have to stretch up to get the belt's prong in that last hole, you will be less likely to exert enough pressure with your own abdominal musculature since it must be contracted to actually generate force. Try this once to see for yourself. When you do, you'll find that there is an optimum tension on the belt and that too tight is worse than too loose. You'll eventually find that your belt adjustment varies with your body weight, your underlying clothing, and even your hydration level. If your belt is designed with holes close enough together to allow for fine adjustment, usually 1 inch apart, it will come in handy. Contrary to the new conventional wisdom regarding this, a belt will not prevent your trunk from getting and staying stronger. It is hard for the layperson, or for that matter, a coach who lacks personal experience with very heavy squats, to understand this, but I assure you that there is not one single relaxed muscle group in the entire human body under a 600-pound squat. This statement most especially applies to the muscles that are busy stabilizing the spine. It's not as if your trunk muscles just go to sleep when you put on your belt. What actually happens is that the abs contract harder against the external resistance provided by the belt than they can without it, in the same way that your arms can contract harder when you curl a barbell than when you curl a broomstick. A belt does, in fact, help you safely lift more weight than you would without one, since a tight back better supports more weight when you're squatting, and squatting more weight allows you to do more work through the range of motion and thus get stronger. Knee wraps are another matter. When a lifter uses tight knee wraps, the 1 meter long or longer heavy kind with various colored stripes, he is doing so to lift more weight. The mechanism is the same with wraps as with squat suits. In the absence of an injury, knee wraps must be considered supportive gear and should not be worn for strength training. But in the event of certain knee injuries, wraps can be very helpful if used correctly. If you have an old ligament injury that is healed as well as it's going to, wraps are useful to add some compression and thus stability to the knee. A light wrap adds just enough circumferential pressure to the whole knee assembly to act almost like an external joint capsule, as well as maintaining warmth and providing proprioceptive input to the skin and superficial structures. The caveat is this: if your wraps are so tight that they must be loosened immediately after the set, then they are acting as aids and not as support. If you can keep the wraps on for the whole workout without cutting off circulation to your lower legs, the wraps are loose enough to be considered only as supportive. Some older lifters with older lifter knees find that wraps a little tighter than loose support wraps make pain-free squatting possible. By adding more support to knees that have aged ungracefully, wraps can make the difference between a productive exercise and a source of irritation. The compression provided by properly applied wraps seems to prevent some of the inflammation that unwrapped older knees experience when the lifter is training the squat heavy. Some heavier powerlifting wraps are so heavy they cannot actually be used as loose support wraps. Their elastic is so heavy that when it is stretched into position over its entire length, even applied loosely, it's just too tight to leave on, and therefore too tight to consider as just supportive. Lighter wraps are available at sporting goods stores and online, and they're fine for our purposes. Rubber and cloth knee sleeves can be used if warmth is the primary objective. Shoes. Shoes are the only piece of personal training equipment that you really need to own yourself. It takes only one set of five and a pair of squat shoes to demonstrate this convincingly to anybody who has done more than one squat workout. A good pair of squat shoes adds enough to the efficiency of the movement that the cost is easily justified. For anywhere from $50 for a used pair to more than $200 for the newest Adidas, a pair of proper shoes makes a big difference in the way the squat feels. Powerlifting style squat shoes have relatively flat soles, and Olympic weightlifting shoes have a little lift in the heel that makes it easier to get the knees forward just in front of the toes. Your choice will depend on your squatting style and your anthropometry. Avoid shoes with heels higher than 1 inch because these are difficult to use for pulls from the floor using the kinematics advocated here, and they produce the same problems as using a 2x4 under the heels. Most squat shoes have metatarsal straps to increase lateral stability, provide some very important arch support, and suck the foot back into the heel of the shoe to reduce intra-shoe movement of the toes. The primary beneficial feature of a squat shoe is its lack of sole and heel compressibility. The drive out of the bottom starts at the floor where the feet start the kinetic chain. If the contact between the feet and the floor is the squishy gel or air cell of a running shoe, a percentage of the force of the drive will be absorbed by the compression of the cell. This compression reduces power transmission efficiency and foot stability. Unstable footing interferes with the reproducibility of the movement pattern, rendering virtually every squat a whole new experience and preventing the development of good technique. Squatting in running shoes is like squatting on a bed. Many people get away with it for years, but serious lifters invest in squat shoes. They aren't that expensive, especially when compared to brand name athletic shoes, and they make a huge difference in the way the squat feels. We have spent a lot of time developing a model of barbell training from the perspective of balance. Poorly designed or incorrectly utilized footwear completely undermines your application of this rather elegant model. Buy the damn shoes. Clothing. A brief word about clothing is in order. It is best to squat in a t-shirt as opposed to a tank top, because t-shirts cover more skin than does a tank top. Skin is slick when sweaty, and slick is not good for keeping the bar in place. The shirt should be 100% cotton or maybe 50-50 polycotton, not all synthetic, because these high-tech materials are always slick under the bar. Shorts, sweats, or training pants should always be made of stretchy material. This is very important because if your pants grab your legs, say at the knee when your pants get sweaty, and they will, I promise, a non-stretch garment will restrict the movement of your legs and interfere with your ability to shove your knees out and use your hips. The same thing is true for shorts that stop right below the knee, even if they are stretchy. Mid-thigh stretchy shorts or simple gray sweats are the best pants for training. And make sure your pants are pulled up. If the crotch hangs down in the middle of your thighs, this will interfere with your knee position. Clothing should not affect your movement in any way and should never, ever make it harder for you to do a thing that is hard already. Squat correctly. Mirrors. Squatting in front of a mirror is really a bad idea. Many weight rooms have mirrors on the wall and have conveniently placed the squat racks near the walls too, making it impossible to squat without a mirror in front of you. A mirror is a bad tool because it provides information only about one plane of the three, the frontal, the one that gives you the least information about your position and your balance. Forward and backward movement is extremely difficult to detect when you're looking straight forward into a mirror. Depth is also very difficult to judge from this direction. Some obliqueness of angle is required to see the relationship between the patella and the hip. But a mirror set at an oblique angle would require that the neck be twisted a little under the load to see it. Cervical rotation under a heavy bar is as bad an idea as cervical overextension under a heavy bar. A mirror can also be distracting because it shows any movements occurring in what should be your invisible, uncluttered background when you're looking down. The human brain being quite sensitive to visual movement, this is not useful when you're trying to concentrate on squatting a heavy weight and some bozo looking at his massive biceps walks behind you during the set. The most important reason to squat without a mirror in front of you is that you should be developing your kinesthetic sense while you squat. When you pay attention to all of the proprioceptive input provided by focusing on your balance point on the floor in front of you, the pressure on your feet, the feel of your back angle, the bar in your hands and against your back, and your general sense of the balance of the movement, your sensory input is much richer than that provided visually by the mirror image. Learn to feel the correct position, not merely to see it. Coaching cues. One more thought. Throughout this book, the term cue will be used. A cue is a movement signal, and it is an important concept in sports pedagogy. Cues are used both by coaches with the athletes they are handling and by athletes for themselves. For a coach, a cue is a signal that causes the athlete to correct some part of the movement he is about to do, as previously discussed with the coach. It has been built into the athlete's understanding of the movement during the process of learning it with the coach. The cue focuses the athlete's attention on the thing he should be thinking about at the time, instead of all the other things he is probably thinking about. A cue is not a long, detailed explanation that introduces a brand new concept just before the lifter performs a PR. Rather, a cue is a word or two, maybe three, seldom four, that reminds but does not explain. A cue should not have to be processed much by the mind that receives it. It should be heard by the ear and sent on down to the place that was waiting for it to trigger the action to which it refers. An example of a cue is chest up. In contrast, lift the chest so that your back gets flat is not a cue. The former can be used after the lifter has assumed the starting position, right before he starts the pull. The latter must be used well before he assumes the starting position, when he can give some thought to what he's about to do. Cues are worked out between the athlete and the coach during training. Cues evolve naturally as the two people communicate with each other about the movement. The coach will develop his favorite ways of explaining key concepts to his athletes over his coaching career. He'll tailor these explanations to fit the needs of the individual he's working with, and cues will develop. Some cues, like chest up, are almost universal due to their usefulness, brevity, and sound. They almost bark the correct position at the athlete. Other cues, which appear to be so nonspecific as to be useless to the person not familiar with them, like now, are in fact specific to a thing decided upon between the coach and the lifter and are extremely individual to that particular situation. Cues must be given in the right circumstances and at exactly the right time, or they do not trigger anything useful. A cue can also be a reminder that you give yourself. It will not necessarily be spoken aloud, although this sometimes helps. It will be the same thing that a coach would say to you under the same circumstances, a reminder of a position problem that you've already worked out but that you need to pay attention to just before doing the movement. As you learn the exercises covered in this book, you should develop your own set of cues that will serve to reinforce good form. As you become more experienced, you will find it necessary to build cues into your approach to each lift, to solve your own individual problems with each movement pattern. You will find that each lift responds to its own reminder, and if you train alone, you'll have to remind yourself. You'll find that there are two basic types of cues, body cues and bar cues. Body cues are references to parts of your body interacting with the bar, like chest up, look forward, or long straight arms. These cues draw awareness to the thing doing the movement, the muscles or body part needing a correction. In contrast, bar cues refer to the object being moved. For instance, if your problem is jerking yourself out of position while coming off the floor in a deadlift, the problem that usually happens when you're in a hurry to get the bar moving too fast, the bar cue might be pull it slow or squeeze it up. As a general rule, body cues draw the lifter's attention to a component of the movement, while a bar cue refers to the whole movement or to a part of it that several components are engaged in. Straight elbows may fix a problem by calling attention to the specific problem addressed. In contrast, keep the bar vertical describes a complicated process of adjusting the three diagnostic angles, which the lifter can easily do by visualizing one simple thing. A bar cue generally means that if you do certain things to the bar correctly, your body will solve the problem. Some people process bar cues better than body cues, and what works for one exercise might not work for another. Deciding which cues to use is just one of the skills that you will develop through experience. The press. The press is the oldest upper body exercise done with a barbell. The day the barbell was invented, the guy who invented it figured out a way to pick it up and shove it up over his head. After all, it is the logical thing to do with a barbell. Equipment has changed quite a bit over the past 100 or so years. We now have barbells that load with plates, racks we can set our bars in and adjust to various heights so that we don't always have to clean the weight to our shoulders first off the floor, and even plates made out of rubber in case we need to drop the weight. But pressing the bar overhead is still the most useful upper body exercise in the weight room. Prior to the rise of bodybuilding, the standard test of upper body strength was the press, or more correctly, the two hands press. The popularity of the bench press has changed this to the detriment of athletes and lifters who never obtained the benefits of the press, which is the more balanced exercise. Bench pressing, a contest lift in powerlifting, actually became popular among bodybuilders first when large pectoral muscles, pecs, they call them, or maybe chesticles, became the fashion in physique contests starting in the 1950s. Powerlifting incorporated the bench press as a standard contest lift in the mid-1960s, thus diminishing the importance of the overhead version of the press among those now training primarily for strength. The final nail in the coffin was the elimination of the clean and press from the Olympic weightlifting competitions after the 1972 Olympics. This unfortunate development changed the nature of Olympic weightlifting training, effectively removing upper body strength from the list of exercises perceived as necessary by most weightlifting coaches. The exercise has continued its decline in both popularity and familiarity, to the extent that today you're quite likely to hear a seated behind-the-neck press described as a military press by the personal trainers in big-box gyms who just don't know any better. So, a terminology lesson is in order. A press refers to a movement performed while standing, whereby a weight is extended to arm's length overhead with the use of the shoulders and arms only. If a barbell is used, the exercise is properly a two-hands press, although it is understood that the unqualified term press refers to a barbell press done with both hands, since lifting the barbell one-handed is not the normal use of the equipment. Any deviation from this description warrants a qualifier. A seated press is a barbell press done in a seated position, an exercise that requires a special bench, unless the lifter is capable of cleaning the weight, sitting down with it on his shoulders, then lowering it to the floor after the set. This restriction limits the amount of weight that can be lifted, and thus the ultimate usefulness of the exercise. A dumbbell press is a standing, simultaneous two-hands movement, unless the alternated or one-hand version is specified. Any press performed supine on a bench is a bench press, the barbell being understood as the equipment unless a dumbbell bench press is specified. If the barbell is used behind the neck, this position is part of the name. Military press refers to the strictest form of the press. A military press is performed without any bend of the hips or back used to start the weight, sometimes with heels together. A behind-the-neck press is a harder movement than a press. Still harder is a seated behind-the-neck press. The use of the flexed and extended knees as an aid in starting the bar off the shoulders means that a push press has been performed. One of the reasons the press was eliminated from Olympic weightlifting was the difficulty most judges had in bringing themselves to red light and excessively weird press. Referred to by the term Olympic press, the form of this movement that developed over the last few years of its presence in the meet was such that the bar was driven up from the shoulders by the use of a combination of a sharp hip flexion from overextension and a shrug of the traps. Some very adept practitioners could lean back to a point almost equivalent to a bench press, rendering the description of the lift as a press from the shoulders rather inaccurate. Our version of the press is adapted from the Olympic press, preserving the full body aspects of the lift but eliminating the excessive layback. The press is the most useful upper body exercise for sports conditioning, primarily because it is not just an upper body exercise. Except for powerlifting and swimming, all sports that require the use of upper body strength transmit that force along a kinetic chain that starts at the ground. Anytime an athlete pushes against an opponent, throws an implement, uses a racket or a club on a ball, or transmits force to an object, that force starts with the feet against the ground. In a press, the kinetic chain, which is the components of the musculoskeletal system involved in the production and transmission of force between the base of support and the load being moved, starts at the ground and ends at the bar in the hands. The kinetic chain in the bench press, in contrast, begins at the point on the bench where the upper back contacts it directly under the bar and ends at the bar in the hands. proficient bench pressers involve their legs all the way down to the ground, using their lower body as a brace for the kinetic chain. But this does not mean that the kinetic chain extends to the ground, since the bench press can be performed with the feet on the bench or even up in the air. As in the squat, where the hands are an important component of the exercise but do not actually move the bar, the lower body is an important part of the bench press without actually being part of the kinetic chain. Even a very proficient bench presser, using the trunk and legs as efficiently as possible, is still pushing against a bench, not balancing the load with his feet and not using his entire body against the ground as he presses. For the press, using the whole body as the kinetic chain is inherent in the movement. Basic bench press performance is different from the press in that it is primarily an upper body exercise. It is an unusual thing in sports to actually place the back against an immovable object and use it to push against something else. It happens after the play is dead in American football if you're under the pile, but not in many other situations. The press involves the entire body, down to the feet against the floor, using all of the trunk musculature, abs and back muscles, and the hips, legs, ankles, wrists, and feet to stabilize the body, while the shoulders, upper chest, and arms press the bar overhead. This kinetic chain, from overhead at full arm's length all the way down to the floor, is the longest possible kinetic chain for the human body. And this makes the press an excellent tool for training your stability under a load. Another difference lies in the basic nature of the movement pattern and its use of the muscle contraction. The bench press starts from the top down with an eccentric contraction and thus has the advantage of a stretch reflex out of the bottom to assist the concentric contraction, the up phase of the lift. In contrast, the press, like the deadlift, starts the drive up, in this case from the shoulders, with the bar at rest. The hardest part of the movement is the first part, getting it started up. A multi-rep set can be modified so that the reps after the first one can start at the top. You drop down and rebound up out of the bottom position, utilizing a stretch reflex, and breathe at the top as you do in a bench press or a squat. But the basic movement, the one done with the heaviest weights for singles, starts at the shoulders from a dead stop. For an exercise to be useful as a conditioning tool for a sport, it must utilize the same muscles and the same type of neurological activation pattern as that sport. It need not be an identical copy of the sport movement. In fact, it's been demonstrated that if a motor pathway of a slower conditioning exercise is too similar to that of the faster sport skill, as in throwing a weighted baseball, interference with correct skill execution will result. You would, in effect, be practicing throwing the ball slower than you actually throw it in the performance. And since you don't throw objects of different weights exactly the same way, you'd also get to practice throwing it slightly wrong. Effective strength training for a sport should incorporate all the muscles involved in the sport in a coordinated way, so that strength is produced in the generalized patterns of movement used in barbell training, and specific to nothing else. Then, sports practice incorporates the newly acquired strength as it develops. A sport such as football requires the use of all the muscles in the body because force is generated against the ground by the hips and legs, transmitted up the trunk, and applied to the opponent through the arms and shoulders. Presses, squats, deadlifts, bench presses, and power cleans develop that strength through progressive training of the strength. And as the athlete gets stronger, football practice precisely applies the strength in the actual pattern of its use. Specifically for the press, it is important to understand that the force is not produced solely and independently by the upper body. The shoulders and arms participate in the production of force, but they are completely dependent on the hips and legs to react against the ground through the feet as they work. In football, the kinetic chain begins at the ground because the feet move first. In pressing, it begins at the bar. Both movements transfer force along this kinetic chain through the trunk, and its isometric function is the same in both. The press provides the pattern of kinetic similarity required of a useful, applicable exercise. The bench press does not, but it does allow the use of heavier weights. We will do them both in this program, but we must realize the strengths and limitations of each exercise. As a general rule, the more of the body involved in an exercise, the better that exercise is. The press produces strength in the trunk muscles, the abs, the obliques, coastals, and back, as well as in the shoulders and arms. It trains the whole body to balance while standing and pressing with a heavy weight in the hands and overhead. It uses more muscles and more central nervous system activity than any other upper body exercise, and it produces force in a more useful direction than does the bench press, in which force is directed at 90 degrees away from the trunk. In football, the arms are usually used at an angle well above 90 degrees. The press, producing force vertically overhead, is not an exact match, but it is much closer to a useful direction than the bench press is. More importantly, if football players put their backs against solid objects positioned at an inclined angle and pushed against them, the inclined bench would be a pretty good exercise, but they don't. Programs that have switched to the incline because of the supposed improved carryover because of the angle ignore the important kinetic chain element of the press that makes it such an important exercise. It is, in fact, possible to press a lot more weight while lying on the bench than while standing with the bar in the hands. So for simple upper body strength, the bench press is the better exercise, and that's why we keep it in this program. Doing both exercises enables the strength developed from the bench press to be applied in a more useful way for sports. Athletes who never do anything but bench press tend to have more shoulder problems than those who include overhead training. With all the pressing emphasis directed to the anterior side of the shoulders, the posterior side gets relatively weak. Since it is possible to bench very heavy weights with years of training, this strength imbalance can be very pronounced. The posterior shoulder musculature includes the very important rotator cuff group of external rotators, the muscles responsible for decelerating internal humeral rotation through throwing movements. The rotator cuff basically consists of the shoulders on the anterior and posterior sides of the shoulder blade, the scapula. The subscapularis covers the front of the scapula, the anterior side, between it and the rib cage, and functions as an internal rotator. The supraspinatus, the infraspinatus, and the teres minor attach at various points on the posterior scapula and to the humerus, and provide for its external rotation as well as deceleration of internal rotation, as when a thrown ball is released. It is possible to work these muscles in isolation as external-internal rotators of the humerus. But that is not their normal function, because isolated rotation is not a normal movement pattern. In a press, they do not work directly as the primary muscles producing the movement, but they are used as stabilizers, and they are therefore strengthened in this capacity. In contrast, the bench press does not work the external rotators much at all, certainly not much in comparison to the loads being handled by the pecs and the anterior deltoids, which function as the main internal rotators of the humerus. If the internal rotators become disproportionately strong, enough to exceed the capacity of the external rotators to decelerate the humerus during a throw, injuries can and often do occur. An injury usually attributed to the press by physical therapists and other medical types is the situation called shoulder impingement. You've probably heard this term. Most of the time, PTs advise against using the press because of the supposed tendency of the tendons of the rotator cuff muscles to become trapped between the head of the humerus and the bony projections on the scapula, known as the coracoid and acromion processes. These bony knobs function as attachment points for the biceps, the pec minor, the coracobrachialis muscle, and the ligaments that hold the scapula and the clavicle together at the acromioclavicular joint, called the AC joint. The coracoid and acromion processes overhang the head of the humerus, where it articulates with the glenoid fossa, the cup, that receives the head of the humerus. Because the external rotators, specifically the supraspinatus and the infraspinatus, overlay the head of the humerus and underlay the subacromial bursa and these bony knobs, most physical therapists believe that the potential for mashing the bones together and trapping the tendons in between, thus impinging these tendons, is so high that the exercise is dangerous and should not be performed. This dogma ignores the anatomical facts about a properly performed press. The scapula is attached to the rest of the shoulder girdle at only one point, the clavicle at the AC joint. Except for the acromioclavicular ligament, the scapula essentially floats freely through its range of motion in a sheath of fascia and muscle, so that its position can change relative to all the other structures of the back, the rib cage, and the humerus. The scapula can move from a position of extreme adduction, as in the bench press, to being pulled forward, as with the start position of a barbell row, to the shrugged up, rotated in at the top position, used at the top of the press. The scapula is quite mobile. When you press overhead, you finish the movement by shrugging your shoulders up toward the bar. This motion engages the trapezius muscles that connect the spinous processes of the vertebral segments in the neck and upper back to the scapulas, and this actively reinforces the trap's support for the shoulders and the bar. In effect, the bar is supported overhead by the locked-in-line arms. The scapulas hold up the arms, and the traps hold up the scapulas. So the shrugged traps actively support the weight of the bar. When the traps contract, they pull the scapulas together at the top so that they rotate medially and superiorly, and the shrug pulls them upward. This motion points the glenoid cavity upward to directly support the humerus from below, and pulls the acromion and coracoid processes away from the humerus. If you press properly, the shrugged upward scapulas are thus positioned to support the arms and the bar overhead, while making impingement of the cuff tendons anatomically impossible. It's important to understand this, because you will hear from medical types about how bad the press is for your shoulders, and it is just not true. The claim that presses impinge the shoulder is not correct. Pressing incorrectly is not the same thing as pressing, and you don't get to redefine the exercise and then claim that it's dangerous. Driving a car is dangerous if you drive it into a great big rock. There are several excellent ways to impinge the shoulder, and none of them involve the press. All you have to do is hold the scapula in position while letting the humerus wedge itself into the bony processes. Bench pressing with an incorrect elbow position, and certain gymnastics movements like ring dips and ring push-ups in the absence of adequate strength preparation are very good ways to put the shoulder in an anatomically or mechanically dangerous situation that you cannot control. Powerlifting is potentially hard on the shoulder's long-term health, and the recent fascination with gymnastics exercises by novice athletes has been responsible for many, many, many surgical procedures that would otherwise not have been necessary. Sports that use an overhead position, like tennis, swimming, and volleyball, but which typically do not press in training to prepare the body for the stresses of that overhead position, experience high rates of shoulder injury and surgery repair. But amazingly enough, shoulder injuries are quite uncommon in Olympic weightlifting, where the point of the sport is to put as much weight overhead as possible. Weightlifters learn very quickly how to hold a weight overhead, while tennis players have perhaps been actively discouraged from learning the safe way to work in this position. Shoulder injuries do occur with significant frequency, and the press has been used for decades to rehabilitate injured shoulders, particularly injured rotator cuffs. Rehabbing this way works for the same reason that it is safe to press, and for the same reason that pressing actually strengthens the rotator cuff muscles. Physical therapy usually addresses shoulder rehab with direct exercises on the rotator cuff that involve rubber bands and 2-pound dumbbells. An interesting approach considering that these isolation movements do not occur as a normal part of typical human movement patterns. But when you press overhead and finish the lockout correctly, all of the muscles of the shoulder are tight and contracted. As the weight goes up over time, the strength of the finish must increase, and the force produced by all of the contracting muscles must therefore increase as well. Since the press uses the rotator cuff muscles isometrically to stabilize the lockout position at the top, and since proper form ensures that they are active in this capacity as well as safe relative to a position of impingement, it seems as though the logical way to strengthen the cuff muscles, even cuff muscles weakened by an injury and surgical repair, is to press correctly. In the correct press lockout, the weaker muscles are supported by the healthy ones. And as the injured muscles heal, they are able to resume an increasing amount of their normal functional load if correct technique is utilized with weights light enough to permit it. In this way, the injured muscles can be brought back to normal function while performing their normal function. In effect, given no chance but to heal by doing what they normally do. Since the press strengthens the shoulders, the key to shoulder health for your whole athletic career and your life as an active adult is to press correctly as an integral part of your training. Most lifters who have shoulder problems have failed to take this advice and have paid for ignoring this most important upper body exercise with an injury. In fact, before the bench press became the sole focus of upper body training in the gym, shoulder injuries were uncommon. Rotator cuff problems can be addressed in training before they ever start by making sure that bench press work is balanced by an equivalent amount of overhead training. For every bench press workout, there should be a press workout. The surprising thing about the press is that it is a very technically demanding lift to do with a lot of weight, and most people work for many years to develop their ability to do it well. So I guess we'd better get started. Learning to press. The press starts at the rack with the empty bar. It should be set at the same height as for the squat, at about the middle of the sternum. If you're a female, a younger trainee, or an older or injured person, be aware of the fact that a 45-pound bar may be too heavy to start with on this exercise. Take steps to ensure that the proper equipment is available, or you will never have a chance to learn the exercise properly. The grip for the press is determined by the simple mechanics we already know. The width is such that it places the forearms in a vertical position as seen from the back or the front at the start. This grip places your index fingers somewhere between the edge of the knurl and a half inch out from the edge of the knurl. Now, there are exceptionally large people who need a little bit wider grip to keep the forearms vertical, but not many. Too wide a grip creates moment arms between the grip position on the bar and the elbows, between the elbows and the shoulders, and between the grip and the shoulders. And these moment arms are leverage you will have to overcome that need not be there at all. The choice of equipment may not be up to you here, and most people will need to work with what they have. So note that a standard Olympic weightlifting bar has about 16 and a half inches of space between the knurls. There's no standard center marking for a powerlifting bar, but most are close to this. It might make things easier if you mark your oddball bar to this standard so that you can use the same grip width every time. The grip should position the bones of the forearm directly under the bar to eliminate any leverage produced against the wrist from having the bar too far back in the hand. The best way to position the grip efficiently is to set the grip width at your index fingers and then rotate your hands into pronation by pointing your thumbs down toward your feet. This setup aligns the bar with the radial longitudinal crease between the thenar eminence, which is the high spot adjacent to the thumb, and the medial palmar eminence on the other side, parallel to your lifeline, to use a more familiar term. Then just lay your fingers down on the bar and squeeze the fingertips into the bar. When you take it out of the rack, the bar will be on the heel of your palm and directly over your forearm bones. Illustrations in the book are very helpful at this point. Note also that this grip produces a wrist extension angle of about 10 to 15 degrees, the angle of extension of a clenched fist, and the most powerful position of contraction for both the extensors and the flexors of the forearm. Test this for yourself by overextending and overflexing your wrist, and then try to contract your hand into a fist in each overextended position. The correct wrist angle permits the greatest amount of squeeze in the forearm muscles and makes the drive from the start position up more efficient. Take the bar out of the rack, the empty bar. Your grip will have placed the bar on the heel of the palms, and your elbows should now move to a position just in front of the bar when viewed from the side. This placement creates a vertical position for the radius bone of the forearm. Most people place the elbows under or behind the bar if they're not taught to do it otherwise, and these positions tend to make the bar drive away from the body when you press. Shrug your shoulders up and forward just a little. The idea is to have the bar resting on top of your anterior deltoids, the meaty part of your shoulders, at the start of the movement. Inflexible people may not be able to get the shoulders far enough forward and up to put the bar in this position at first. If flexibility is the problem, you will stretch out quickly. Some people have long forearms relative to the length of their upper arms, and this anthropometry makes getting the bar on the deltoids impossible with the elbows in the correct position and a narrow grip. Sitting on the delts is the ideal position for the bar, but the movement can be done from a less than perfect position without any real problem. Very flexible people should make sure not to raise the elbows too high. Doing so pulls the scapula forward and produces a lack of tightness and stability across the shoulder blades that is not conducive to an efficient press. Your stance in the press is not as precisely critical as it is in the squat. Take a comfortable stance and you will usually end up with something that will work. Your squat stance actually works well for the press. Too narrow a stance creates a balance problem. And much further apart than the squat stance will feel pretty weird. We will not be using a ground reaction in this lift since it is not a push press. So don't worry about trying to simulate a vertical jump stance for this lift. In fact, when in doubt, go a little wider. A wider stance is more beneficial for the press. Many initial position problems can be prevented with the correct positioning of the eyes. Look straight ahead to a point on the wall that is level with your eyes. This assumes that you are in a facility with walls. If the walls are too far away or you're outside or something like that, a piece of equipment nearby will do. Stare at that point for the whole set. You might need to give yourself a point to look at. If you need to, draw a big dot on a sheet of paper and hang it up at the point that causes your eyes to hold the correct position. Now lift your chest. This is actually accomplished by placing the upper part of the erector spinae in contraction. It's actually a back movement. Think about lifting your sternum up to your chin or showing off your boobs. Sorry for the coarse analogy, but, you know, it does evoke the image, does it not? Chest up is really a back contraction. Again, and the press and the front squat are the two best exercises for strengthening and developing control of these muscles. Lifting your chest produces tightness in the upper back and in the entire kinetic chain, making your connection to the ground more stable and improving your pressing mechanics overall. When your elbows are up correctly and you have lifted your chest, you are ready to press the bar. The press is learned in two stages. First, you will put the bar where it's going to be in the finished position at the top at lockout. This step consists of learning the lockout position and the anatomical and mechanical reasons for using it. And then second, you will learn how to get the bar there correctly. This step consists of learning how to produce a mechanically efficient bar path and how to use your whole body to do it. Step 1. Take a big breath and hold it. Our friend the Valsalva maneuver again. You'll hear this from time to time as we go through the book. And drive the bar up over your head. The vast majority of people will press the bar up to lockout, but in a position just in front of the forehead. Make sure that you have the bar directly above the back of your neck, which is a point that should have the bar, the glenohumeral joint, your shoulder joint, and the midfoot in a straight vertical line. The position of the bar has nothing to do with the neck. It should be vertical to the point of rotation, which is the glenohumeral joint. This is a position in which there is minimal leverage operating against the primary segments of the kinetic chain, the bar to the shoulder and the shoulder down to the midfoot. If the bar is directly plumb to the shoulder joints, the load applies no leverage to the shoulders. If the shoulders are plumb to the midfoot, the back and the legs apply no leverage to the balance point. If the bar is plumb to the midfoot, the entire kinetic chain is in simple compression with no leverage against the primary segments at lockout. Once the bar is over your head correctly, lock your elbows and shrug up your shoulders to support the bar. The bones of the arm are lined up in a column by the triceps and the deltoids. The shoulders are shrugged up with the trapezius, and the arms and the traps must work together to support heavy weights overhead. Imagine someone behind you gently pushing your elbows together and pulling them up at the same time. The combination of locking the elbows out and shrugging the traps up at lockout with the bar directly over the ears produces a very firm, stable position at the top that involves all of the shoulder girdle muscles and prevents shoulder impingement. It is helpful to think about the lockout as a continuation of the upward drive, as though you are really never finished pressing the bar upward. When the load is heavy, this cue provides the last little push necessary to get the bar into the lockout position. Think about pressing the bar up to the ceiling like you're not through. Step 2. After this lockout position is correct, it is time to learn how to best drive the bar up into this position. This step involves making the bar path correct and establishing the proper movement of your body in relation to the bar. Since the bar is sitting on your deltoids in front of the neck, and it must move up to a position above the shoulder joints, several inches behind the starting position, there must be a relative lateral movement of several inches on the way up. But barbells like to travel up in straight vertical lines, up and down, especially when they're heavy. Our vertical bar path must therefore be produced in a way that takes the load from a position in front of the shoulders to the lockout position plumb to the shoulder joints. We do this with the motion of the hips. First, with your hands on your hips, squeeze your quads tight to lock the knees hard in extension. And then squeeze your abs tight to set your lumbar spine from the front. This squeezing from rib cage down to knees creates a band of tension from upper body to lower body that we will use to create a rebound. Once this tension is built, push your hips forward so that your weight goes forward onto your toes. Now, this movement must not be produced by bending the knees or the lumbar spine. The movement occurs only in the hips as they push forward into the tension created across them by the abs and the quads. once this movement is successfully created by moving only the hips. Push into it fast and feel the rebound as you reach the limit of the tension forward. Your weight should shift onto the toes and then back to the midfoot as you recenter after the rebound. This movement will not involve your pulling the hips back, but rather rebounding the hips off of the tension forward. Pulling back is not the movement pattern we're looking for. Rebounding from the front is. Like drawing a bow, the maximum tension will be at the furthest point of the movement forward, and the tension will then drive the hips back as it is released. This motion will create a bounce off of the front of the tension that will cause the shoulders to move down and up a little during the motion as the distance between the bar and the floor is shortened by the curve. Take the empty bar out of the rack, making sure your grip and elbow position are correct, and repeat the same motion with the bar in the hands. Make a springy platform for the bounce by tightening your armpit, the lat against the triceps. Done correctly, you will notice the bar drop down a little at the forward extent of the hip reach, and the bar rebounding upward as your hips bounce back. Bounce the bar several times like this, and once you can predictably generate an up and down bounce with this reaching forward of the hips, catch the upward bounce and drive the bar up to lockout. The press takes place after the hips have rebounded off the front of the tension, not before. If your timing is wrong, you will do a layback and press, and the bar will not bounce. Most people find that the press follows the bounce quite naturally, so make the bar bounce in your grip and try it again. As soon as the bar crosses the top of your forehead, get under the bar. Move your body forward under the bar and drive it to lockout. Don't move the bar back. Slam yourself forward under the bar. You can't move the bar back when it's heavy. The only thing you can do is move yourself forward under the bar. When you do this correctly, you will find that the forward torso movement contributes to lockout at the top, as the shoulder drives forward. The contracting deltoid and tricep bring the upper arm and the forearm into alignment, thus driving up the bar. Do this for a set of five and rack the bar. Do as many sets as necessary with the empty bar to clarify the concept of bouncing back off of the anterior tension and moving yourself forward under the bar, as opposed to moving the bar back to the shoulder joint. Make sure you push your hips forward before you start to press, because it's very common to start the press with a vertical torso and then lean back as the bar starts up. Hips forward and rebound off the forward tension must occur before the press starts, or the bar will travel forward around your chin, not up in an efficient vertical path. The timing here is critical. Feel the bounce, follow the bounce with the drive up, and you'll be doing the bar correctly. To further reinforce the vertical bar path, think about keeping the bar close to your face on the way up. Aim for your nose as the bar leaves your shoulders. Then, as you lower the bar for the next rep, aim for the nose on the way down as well. You may actually hit yourself in the nose before you figure this out, but you'll probably just do it once. By establishing a bar path close to your face on both the eccentric and concentric parts of the movement, you practice keeping the bar close to the shoulders from the very first sets of the exercise. After as much practice with the empty bar as is necessary, start up in 5, 10, or 20-pound jumps, whatever is appropriate for your age and strength, until the bar speed begins to slow markedly at the fifth rep of the set, and this is your first workout. Faults and corrections. There won't be nearly as many problems with the press as there are with the squat and deadlift, because there are fewer muscle groups actively participating in the movement of the bar. Most problems are either starting position problems or bar path problems, and they result in a missed press for really just two reasons. You fail to get the bar off your chest, or the distance between the shoulder and the bar becomes too long a moment arm to overcome. These are the bar path problems. The first problem happens because you have lost your tightness in the start position due to breathing errors, positioning errors, chest not up, elbows not up, etc., or a focus error, or because you have just gotten tired or the weight is too heavy. The second problem occurs because you have produced an incorrect bar path. You push the bar forward instead of up. You failed to hold your position under the bar as you pushed it up, or you failed to get back under the bar after it crossed your forehead. So let's look at the conditions under which these errors occur and figure out how to prevent them. Losing tightness. There are two types of upper back looseness that commonly screw up the press. The first type, caused by letting the chest cave in so that the upper back rounds, is